Good morning, Santa Fe, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We are broadcasting from the studios of KSFR and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. And we're podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. I'd like to welcome Marnia Lazreg. She is professor of sociology at Hunter College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and her newest book is Torture and the Twilight of Empire, From Algiers to Baghdad, published by Princeton University Press. Welcome to KSFR.
Thank you.
Now, the subject of your study is the Algerian War, which took place from 1954 to 1962, and the relationship between colonial power and torture in that context. First of all, tell us about the Algerian War. Who was fighting and what were they fighting over?
Right. We have to understand that Algeria had been colonized in 1830, and between 1830 and 1954, when the war for decolonization started, the Algerian population did not have the same political, economic, or civil rights, you know, as the French colonists. And poverty had increased over the years. And by 1954, a group of young nationalists started the war against, you know, the French. So this is how it all started. It was really a war that was precipitated by the degree and extent of poverty, the pauperization or impoverishment of the population. The war became very important for a number of countries, you know, to study, because between 1954 and 1962, the French military had formulated a military doctrine, called counter-revolutionary doctrine or counter-insurgency, anti-subversive war, in which torture figured prominently as a war weapon, or as one of the theorists put it, an antidote to terrorism. So the protagonists or the antagonists were, you know, the Front of National Liberation in French, FLN, and on the French side, of course, the French Army. And here we see evidence, you know, of, you know, what, or rather we see signs of what's, you know, happening in Iraq and Afghanistan today.
Tell us more about this doctrine of post-World War II war theory, this anti-subversive doctrine. We saw it in the Algerian War. We've seen it ever since. And it's about a kind of a theory of fighting war, which is no longer one army against another.
Absolutely. That's a very, very important question. We have to, you know, realize that, you know, when the French officers, you know, came up with this theory, they were being defeated in Vietnam. Vietnam was also a French colony, and by May 1954, the French army had been defeated at Dien Bien Phu. Some of the officers who had been fighting the war of decolonization in Vietnam had already been thinking about how the new war in the aftermath of World War II would not be a conventional war pitting two conventional professional armies against each other. Rather, it would be a war which they called a new war, and you see the echo here. You know, in the U.S. we talk about, you know, the war on terror as being a new war. So they felt the new war would be pitting a professional traditional army against a population, because that army would be fighting groups of people who would find support in the population, and indeed, you know, they are people who come out of the population. So they felt that the methods that characterize conventional wars have to be revolutionized, they have to be changed. So they came up with a new unit that would be modeled after the organization of the guerrillas. So you would have soldiers operating in small groups, carrying very light equipment, and ambushing, you know, the guerrillas, just like the guerrillas were ambushing the French army. And they would be carrying with them portable torture equipment. And after an ambush or during an ambush, if they captured one of the native combatants, they would subject him to torture right there and then so that he would give them, you know, what they called operational intelligence, and which, you know, here in this, you know, in the U.S. we call actionable intelligence. So it was a new war in the sense, quote-unquote, new war in the sense that the army adapted itself, you know, to the methods of the guerrilla fighters. And they had had this experience in Vietnam, and they were now faced with what, you know, people they called rebels or insurgents who were also, you know, organized, you know, as guerrilla groups. So this is a very interesting doctrine in the sense that it declared the population as a war front. So the war was taking place in and against the population. And since the population is a different population than the one, you know, that, you know, the, you know, organized army, you know, comes from in Algeria, just like, you know, in Iraq, you know, you have a predominantly Muslim population that speaks a different language, that have, you know, different customs. So you don't know who is your friend and who is your enemy. So the population was defined as both friend and enemy. And so in a situation of war, you cannot tell the difference between friends and enemies. So you use torture as a screening device. And this is what makes these wars particularly abhorrent and, you know, very extreme.
One of the assumptions by the colonial power in this theory, in this case France, but it could be anybody who's applying this theory, is the superiority of their own culture to the culture that they're, that they have colonized. How does this play out, and who is believing that they are superior? Why is this important in the dynamic of this kind of anti-subversive war?
That, too, is a very, very important question, because, you know, fighting a war of occupation is a very challenging fight. And it's challenging not only militarily, but it is also challenging because the morale of the troops becomes an issue of concern. When torture is condoned by the state and the military engages in it systematically, you have to present it to the troops as a very, you know, objectionable method, perhaps, but a very necessary method. And in order for a torturer to engage, you know, in systematic torture, he has to be trained in how to look at the tortured person. And here, of course, in the schools of counterinsurgency, which the French, you know, had established in Algeria, there were at least, you know, two major ones. The recruits, the conscripts, were taught about the ideology of colonialism, that France is fighting not only, you know, people who, you know, want to recover, you know, a country that, you know, France felt belonged to it, but in Algeria, France was fighting for the French way of life, for French values, and these values and this way of life, you know, are superior to those of the local population. And so they created, the French theorists created a profile of the average Algerian who was defined as being, quote-unquote, primitive, as not having, you know, the same manner of thinking as, you know, the French, as being a sous-homme, meaning a subhuman individual who is now being pushed, you know, by, you know, some, you know, troublemakers to rebel against the benevolence of France. So when the torturer tortures, you know, a native, he's not really, in his mind, torturing a human being like himself. He's torturing someone who is inferior. And indeed, there was even one seminarian who happened to, turn over a villager to a torturer and sit there and, you know, watch and write, you know, about, you know, how an individual reacts to torture. This one particular seminarian even said, well, you know, maybe Algerians are really fundamentally different, you know, from us. Maybe they require force. And there was a theory elaborated by the French military that Algerians call, you know, for force, that you cannot speak to them except, you know, through force. This is their nature. So the more you dehumanize, you know, the native population whom you're fighting, the better it becomes, you know, to torture them, because then you establish a big distance, you know, between the torturer and the tortured, and then you might have, you know, actually some a priest, and there was one, Father de la Rue, who intimated that, you know, torture is a tool of redemption of these fallen individuals, fallen from humanity, and therefore torture humanizes them. And what is even more interesting is that the army taught in one of its counterinsurgency schools about humane torture. So imagine, you know, counterposing, you know, the concept of humanity to, you know, torture, which is all but human or humane.
We're talking to Marnia Lazarek. I mean, immediately, this, the moment you start getting into this subject, the contradictions are so painful to behold. For example, the French, who think of themselves as civilized, using torture, which is the most barbaric and cruel of all possible things, to do what they call, for example, pacification. It's positively Orwellian.
Yes, absolutely. And this is, absolutely, you put your finger on it. Yes, you know, this is the core contradiction at the heart of wars of, you know, reoccupation or occupation, that the French military was, you know, quite aware of this. So they would say, well, we are going to be destroying the infrastructure of the, you know, Front of National Liberation. But since that infrastructure was, you know, the population itself, because these were people coming out of the population and finding support in the population, they'd say, and then we start pacifying the population. And what that meant was, in fact, you know, holding people hostages, you know, in their villages, and providing them then with some social services and some medical services. But the medical, the military medical, you know, doctors were also, you know, providing intelligence, you know, to the army units, you know, to which they were attached. So you had this a theory that upheld destruction on the one hand, and winning, quote-unquote, the hearts and minds of the population. So you can't have it both ways. You cannot arrest people arbitrarily and subject them to the most extreme form of, you know, pain and suffering, and then say, well, we can give you some services, you know, medical services, which were not sufficient anyway, but which the French, you know, had, you know, failed, you know, to provide over, you know, their 124 years, you know, of colonization.
There was there's another way in which they were trying to have it both ways, and this is something you write about in the chapter on the role of women in the Algerian War. You write about the way women were, on the one hand, subjected to just brutal terrorism, including rape, and then on the other hand, they were subjected to a kind of feminism imposed by the French.
Yes, absolutely. And the woman question is a very, very interesting and intriguing one. The doctrine of fighting a quote-unquote an insurgency was assumed a male fighter, a native male. But in 1956, the army found a number of women working on the side of the FLN, And they also found some more interesting things that increasingly, in many parts of Algeria, people were turning to the FLN for registering their marriage ceremonies, for example, for seeking resolutions of their disputes. So the FLN was in many regions, you know, trying to replace, if you will, the French administration. So I found, you know, documents in the archives, you know, indicating how the military was worried about, you know, what it felt was a silent social revolution taking place in Algeria, featuring women, because now the French conception of, you know, the Algerian woman was that, you know, she was veiled, she was quote-unquote oppressed, so they had no worries, you know, about women. And then when they discovered that women actually were, you know, engaged actively on the side of the FLN, they decided to undermine that revolution and to some degree also spearheaded themselves. Hence the adaptation of their military doctrine to the gender situation. So they targeted women in two ways. On the one hand, they wanted to make of them de facto liaison agents by asking them to appeal to their relatives, you know, male relatives who might be in the mountains, you know, fighting on the side of the guerrillas. And they would tell them, well, convey a message to your husband or to your son or to your, you know, cousin, uncle, and tell him that he should surrender and that France will be very, very forgiving and we will not give them, you know, stiff sentences. That's one thing. Two, then with the help of a corps, a special corps of social workers, you know, French social workers who were who were working for the military, they were trained in techniques of indoctrination and propaganda, and their lesson plans were actually devised, you know, formulated, you know, drawn by the military intelligence, you know, officers. And these women were sent into villages and into the homes, you know, of, you know, Algerian rural women or semi-rural women, ostensibly to offer them support with how to raise their children, provide some clothing for the children, some food, and, you know, every week they would sit with them and lecture them about, you know, how to do this and that, and at the same time tell them about the benevolence of France and about the superiority of French culture. And very, very adroitly, they'd say, well, look at yourselves. You know, if you were like French women, if you dressed like French women, then you would feel quite differently. You would be having a different, you know, kind of life altogether. So the first thing for you is to take your veil off because there is no reason for you to wear it, and you're wearing it because your husband is demanding that you wear it. So they were trying to sow discord between husbands and wives as a means of, you know, shoring up the alleged superiority of French culture, and at the same time they wanted to inculcate into these women's, you know, minds the notion that their culture was inferior and that France, you know, was in Algeria in order to support women. And so this you have to realize that at the time the veil was the least of the problems, you know, that, you know, these women had. The bulk of them were totally, you know, illiterate, uneducated. There were very, very few schools built by France, you know, for Algerian women. There were 24,000 women working in 1954, most of whom were maids, you know, in French homes. In any case, the veil became an issue for the French military, and so I poke fun at it and saying this is military feminism. It wasn't feminism at all. It was really a political cynicism. So campaign against the veil reached its climax in 1958. It was May 16, 1958, when a group of generals organized an unveiling ceremony in Algiers, the capital of Algeria, and also in provincial capitals. And they called the press in, and before thousands of people, they would ask in Algiers. There were 10 women, and apparently most of them were maids, working in the generals' homes. They were asked to drop their veils, at which point one of the generals said the last obstacle to a French Algeria had fallen. And in provincial, there is evidence that in one provincial capital, a young woman who was an intern in, she was in a dorm, rather, in high school, she was brought in by force and was told, you are going to wear a veil, which she never wore, and you're going to be dressed in the French flag, as an Algerian representation of the French, Republic. As you know, the French Republic has a female name, it's Marianne. So she was, the Algerian counterpart of, the mythical, French Marianne. And she was, asked to come to the podium and in the city of Constantine in eastern Algeria and to drop her veil, a veil she never wore before, on cue, and to show her dress, which was cut, out of the French flag. And she was interviewed years later, and she said, she was in tears, but they told her that if she did not do that, then her brother, who was in one of the detention camps, would be in serious trouble.
We're talking to Marnia Lasreg. The book is called Torture and the Twilight of Empire. I was thinking as I was reading your book how horrible it is to confront the reality of torture, whether you're hearing about it on the radio or reading a book. And some people who are listening right now might want to turn off the radio. But then I was thinking how it's nothing to listen to this or read it compared to having that horrible experience. And therefore, it's kind of our duty, we who are living in relative comfort and freedom, to actually go through this and confront it in order to understand the roots of this horrible human phenomenon, namely torture. That said, I was wondering, what's it like for you to study this subject year after year, to stick with it? Because it really is quite a gruesome set of stories that you tell.
Indeed. But, as you said, we really have to confront the phenomenon of torture. We have to come to terms with it because, look, what's happening today in Afghanistan and in Iraq and in Guantanamo Bay is really quite similar to what happened in Algeria during the 1950s. If anything, the very doctrine that the military used in Algeria was also used in Vietnam, especially in Operation Phoenix in 1968, and it is also used today in one form or another in Iraq and in Afghanistan, and this is done in our name. So it doesn't help really to tune off or look the other way when things are being done in our own name. More than that, it is my firm belief that we are all torturable. And when one person is tortured in one place in the world, our humanity is also affected by that torture because we too could be tortured. I looked through the books written by very, very, notable intellectuals, in the U.S., and they justify torture. And I kept telling myself, how could they do that? Because they, too, could be tortured.
Yeah.
Torture is really a very, very, extreme phenomenon. And when the lawmakers who prohibited it knew exactly what they were doing, because once you start it, you are on a slippery road. You really cannot stop it. Torture, once it is condoned and it is started, it cannot be stopped easily. So this is why its prohibition must be absolute. And actually, the United Nations, which had formulated the Convention Against Torture in 1985, have come up with an addendum to that Convention Against Torture last November, November 2007, which reiterates the non-derogable character of torture, and they added, and also ill treatment. And they made it also a violation of the convention for any country that resorts to torture under quote-unquote special circumstances. And this is a wonderful document because it says there is absolutely no circumstance, no exceptional reason for which, you know, torture could be practiced by anyone. Torture is simply non-derogable.
So what was the process in the Algerian War by which the intelligence service was set up and then torture became routine? What was the initial rationale, and then how did the practice of torture take on a life of its own?
Well, the original rationale is the same as the one we're hearing about, you know, in the press today in the context of the war in Iraq, which is gathering intelligence. In fact, the intelligence that one gathers through torture is not reliable. I'll give you the example of one individual who was tortured mercilessly in Algeria, and he didn't break, he didn't talk, and so the French torturers decided to try the truth serum on him. This was the truth serum was still new at that time, and so they gave him the shot, and he started telling them about all the things that he had done. That, you know, he killed, you know, 100 people in one place, and he killed another 50 in another, and he did this and that and that. And so they were really very happy. They thought the serum really worked. And then they decided to check the confessions, and they found that one after another of the things that this man, you know, said he had done were not true. And so I found this case, you know, truly, you know, emblematic of, you know, the whole issue of, you know, torture as being a good method for eliciting intelligence, you know, from an individual who may or may not have it. So, in fact, this man was simply hallucinating and dreaming, and probably his unconscious mind had been, you know, unleashed, and these were the things that he wished he had done, but in fact he hadn't done. So torture is not about intelligence. Torture is about far more than intelligence. It is first about terror, because torture is a very, very significant, efficient tool of terror, because for one thing it happens, you know, in secret, and people also disappear, you know, after they have been tortured. So torture really, you know, brings fear to the heart, you know, of the population that is subjected, you know, to occupation. Torture was also used in the Algerian context, you know, as a step towards brainwashing. And this was, you know, a manner in which, you know, the French intelligence, you know, officers, you know, had put together various, you know, psychological theories, and the upshot of which was that if you use, you know, pain of a certain intensity, you could then disrupt, you know, the pattern of thinking of, you know, the victim, and that means, you know, that the resistance of the victim is lowered, and then after that you could then inculcate, you know, to that victim, you know, whatever you want, and that's brainwashing. And just to open, you know, parenthesis here, the CIA has invested $1 billion a year between 1952 and 1962 in research on the effects of sensory deprivation in psychological torture, and how you can actually disrupt the pattern of thinking of a person, and also you regress their personality to an earlier stage, and that, you know, would enable you then, you know, to make them talk and, you know, to brainwash them. So torture really is not about intelligence. It's about all of these, you know, things I have just said. In addition, torture is the best tool for an occupying country to project an image of power and force. And indeed, torture represents the application and implementation of unbounded force.
We're talking to Marnia Lasrek. You write that sex, including rape, is at the core of torture. Talk about that, the sexual aspect of torture. I think that this is something that's extremely important that is not talked about nearly enough.
Absolutely. If you remember the infamous images, you know, that came out of Abu Ghraib with all of those prisoners, you know, hooded and naked, and Linda England, you know, walking a man on a leash, you know, a naked man. Sex is at the core of torture. Why? Because our identity is grounded in our sexuality. And sex is when you play with the genitals of a prisoner, when you simulate, you know, orgasm by putting electricity to the genitals, you know, of a prisoner. What you're doing is humiliating them. And humiliation is a very, very powerful tool for breaking the resistance of the individual. You do sensory deprivation, which disrupts the pattern of thinking of the individual. Then you do humiliation, which is always sexual, you know, humiliation. You rape men. By, you know, when you rape a man, you're telling him, you know, that, you know, he's not, you know, you're attacking his, you know, his masculinity. You're breaking it, you know, down. One of the people who had been tortured sexually in Iraq, he said, it's one thing to sustain, you know, physical pain, but it's another thing to see your manhood destroyed. You do the same thing to women, too, and women experience, of course, rape in a different way than men do. But and one thing that the French, you know, didn't do, which, you know, we are doing in both, you know, Guantanamo Bay and Iraq and Afghanistan, is using women to inflict the sexual torture on the prisoners. And this is based on a pseudo knowledge of Islam and, you know, Iraqi and, you know, Afghan cultures. You have a woman who exposes, you know, herself. She's naked. She presents herself naked, you know, before a prisoner. She smears her breast with a red paint to simulate menstrual blood, and she rubs herself against the prisoner. And the idea is that she knows that he is a Muslim, and her conception is that a Muslim man is a very prudish man. He doesn't see women who are naked. He's going to really be so shocked, and also he's going to feel that he's polluted, you know, by the menstrual, the fake, you know, menstrual blood, and that will be sufficient, you know, to break his resistance. One has to remember that, you know, a number of the men who have gone through this treatment after they were released from Guantanamo Bay, or after they escaped, you know, from some of the jails, you know, in Afghanistan, they immediately, joined, you know, some of the, groups, you know, that we call insurgents. So sex is really at the core of torture, and, you know, for the principal reason that the aim of sexual torture is to humiliate and degrade in the individual and attack him where it hurts the most, in his identity or her identity.
One can't help but think of the role of the torturer in that, in especially in those sexual instances. I mean, that person is very much a player in a kind of horrifying, intimate drama. Yes. You know, and I wondered if you could talk about the psychology of the torturer. We know that many torturers feel no empathy or pain or remorse or even any kind of understanding of the role they're playing in this drama.
Absolutely. We have this understanding that's, you know, sustained, you know, by some of the statements, you know, made by the military, that, you know, torture takes place in an unauthorized manner, and the people who torture are really rough, unsophisticated, you know, uneducated people. That is really far from the truth. I'll give you an example. General Paul Osares, who had, tortured thousands of people and killed quite a few of them under torture, wrote a book. He's in his late 80s now. Wrote a book 5 or 6 years ago, in which, you know, he confessed, you know, to all the tortures that he engaged in, and described how he tortured. And at the end of his book, said, "I regret absolutely nothing. I just hope that others will not have to go through, wars, such as the war in Algeria." There are cases, torturers are professionals. They are trained. As I said, the French, had, schools, where they trained, their recruits, quote unquote, humane torture. We know that in the U.S. we train, also people in counterinsurgency wars, and that includes, torture. The professional torturer does a job. And one such, people said in an interview with a French reporter that he did not recommend that any torturer engages, in his profession for more than 2 years, because he said after the second year, then you begin to enjoy it, and then you become a sadist. And what drew my attention, when I read, the confession of this man, was the fact that he said at the end, one is not born a torturer, one becomes a torturer. And that is, absolutely, absolutely true. So, some torturers do become sadists, but people who torture are not necessarily sadists. They do, what they think is right. Many of the torturers in Algeria had bought into the ideology of the military, that they were doing this, for the greatness of France. They were fighting for the values of France. And we have similar things happening in Iraq. There are some veterans of the Iraq War who are very convinced that they went into Iraq and, they killed and did all sorts of things in the name of human rights. Again, you are engaging, in some, very unsavory activities in the name of human rights. There is also Tony Lagoranis, who was an interrogator in Iraq, and he wrote a book called Fear Up Harsh. Fear up harsh is one of the techniques that is allowed, by the counter-insurgency, the U.S. Army Intelligence and Interrogation Handbook. And Mr. Lagoranis argued that he was not prepared to torture people, but when he arrived there, he was told to interrogate, and interrogation meant torture, and he found himself engaged in the torture of many, many Iraqi people. And he also said, but I didn't get any information from these people that would be, worth, torturing them. And hence, he had to write, a book about, what happened to him. So, yes, the psychology of the torturer is not that much different from the psychology of the average individual. One becomes a torturer. One is not born a torturer.
The book is called Torture and the Twilight of Empire. Tell us more about the connection between torture, which is a very personal action of one person toward another, an empire, which is a large-scale set of political ambitions.
Yes, indeed. That is a very important question. Yes, the empire, you know, from the outside, you know, is, you know, a systems, if you will, a notion, and it comes from the outside. It evokes, you know, governments and policies, political systems. But empires are based on, and they produce, you know, identities. There is an imperial identity. If you look at the memoirs written by generals, you know, who were hardliners during the Algerian War, one of them, General Salon, wrote, "To lose an empire is to lose one's identity." You have to understand that, you know, imperial powers are really not anonymous, you know, powers. They are driven and they are based on individuals. So having an empire also affects, you know, the individual's identity. And the challenge for the French army was how to convince conscripts who had never set foot in any one of the regions, you know, under the control of France, how to convince, you know, young men to think in terms of, you know, the empire instead of France proper, where they were born and where they grew up. So conflating national identity and imperial identity became a challenge for the French army. Nevertheless, you know, at the end of an empire, a group of politicians or army generals pauses, and I find this, you know, pause, you know, very interesting, and they start looking back at what constitutes, you know, the glory of their nation or the power of their nation, and they realize that the empire, you know, was a source, you know, of not only power at the governmental level, but, you know, power at the individual level, and they decided that they were losing something of themselves. They were individually invested in the domination of, you know, millions of people, and they wanted to keep that at by all means necessary, and torture was one of those means because, you know, it was part of this, you know, doctrine of keeping the empire and not letting go of it. We have a similar thing here. If you look at the end of the Cold War, the Department of Defense issued a document called the Defense Policy Guidance. Classified. This was in 1992, and then it was leaked to the media, and then it was unclassified, and it reappeared in 1993 under the title Defense Strategy for the 1990s, the Regional Defense Strategy. And this is a very extreme a plan of action for the U.S., a little bit similar in the functionally, you know, it's like the functional equivalent of the military doctrine, you know, of the French generals, in the sense that what the French were doing was theorizing, you know, the greatness of the empire and giving, you know, guidelines about how to fight for it, you know, on the ground, whereas the defense strategy says, we shall keep our power and expand it and prevent any regional power from challenging not only our economic interests, but also our values. And, of course, one can define values in very different ways. And so you have then a document that is a blueprint for, you know, ventures, unilateral ventures, and one of which, you know, is really the venture, you know, in Iraq. So the U.S., you know, wanted, you know, to remain a superpower in a world that is, in fact, increasingly self-directed.
We're talking to Marnia Lasrek. So let's talk just a little bit more about the parallels between the Algerian War and the invasion and occupation of Iraq. Yes. I mean, when you tell some of the stories about soldiers in the Algerian War going into villages and what they did. You could be reading about the exact same stories of things of, that are happening in Iraq today and in the last 5 years.
Absolutely. Also, not only Iraq, I should add, but also Afghanistan.
Right.
You have first ground troops, of course, and that you always have that. And you have also these, mobile units. What you have, the excesses are similar. Each time an American soldier, is killed, you have retaliation. And this has been documented now by people who have come back, from Iraq, not only just the reporters, but also members of the military. You have retaliations, retaliation is always blind. And that means that, people who haven't done anything, innocent civilians, get killed. And that, of course, causes, more of the population to turn against, the occupier. You have torture being practiced in all of the detention places, in Iraq as well as, in Afghanistan. Just like what happened in Algeria, you have the jail system becoming, overtaxed. There was an article in the New York Times recently indicating that the surge that was supposed to be so positive actually resulted in a large number of people being detained without, good cause. So you have 26,000 prisoners in military detention centers, in Iraq, in addition to a similar number of people detained by the Iraqi government. So you have, also something very, very important that, very few people are realizing, which is that the army finds itself doing the work of the government. You have, young men in their 20s and in their 30s using millions of dollars to induce, one tribe in Afghanistan to be on their side, say, we're going to build you a well, we're going to build you a road, or arbitrating, between tribes. And the same thing is happening in Iraq, and that's exactly what the French did. The more the war developed and, continued, the more the military supplanted the state in the discharge of, social and economic functions. And that is usually very, very dangerous because the army is not trained to do that kind of work. It's one thing to say, well, we're going to bring in engineers and design a road, but it's another to get involved, in arbitrating between, sectarian factions, or tribal disputes, and deciding who gets what. The state, allocates resources, not the army. And so the army becomes very resentful when this continues because it is taxed, it's not trained for this kind of work, and then you get a very, very serious, conflict between the civil, administration and the army. And that, would come next, if we continue the war in Iraq.
Marnia Lazarek, unfortunately, it's time to go, but I want to thank you so much for being with us here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much for having me.
Marnia Lazarek is the author of the book Torture and the Twilight of Empire, From Algiers to Baghdad, published by Princeton University Press. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're also podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, jazz.